Welcome to another episode of the Equip Podcast. I'm Brandon.
Nice to meet you, Brandon.
Who are you guys?
I'm Ron Burgundy.
We're off to a great start.
This is awesome. This is how I was hoping this would go. Stay classy, San Diego.
San Diego.
What's that, Baxter? All right. So this is Jordan, a.k.a. Ron Burgundy, and John Irvin, as most of you who watch this, all 35 of you know, these two guys. And so, but we are excited to be here today, and I've been looking forward to this, to get these two guys together. And our goal with this is we really want to be able to look back at the early beginnings of the church, and I want to talk to them a lot about and really have three different lenses to look through as we look at the growth of the church over the years and how that just really took off exponentially. And we've got three really unique viewpoints of that. And where we want all this to lead is into how all of that growth brought us to a place of recognizing that the way we were doing church wasn't the most healthy way of doing it. And we all had kind of different paths to get to that place. We all had different parts that we played in that. And we'll talk about all of this as we get into this, but I'm really looking forward to it. And ultimately, what we want to do is over a few different podcasts is look at this broken system of church that we feel like we existed in for a long time and we're trying to work out of now. And hopefully this becomes something that for our people and hopefully people outside of Connection Church are able to look at it and begin to recognize some of the same things we did, but also find maybe a healthier way of doing church with a plurality of leadership that I think has been super beneficial for us, has made us healthy. It answers succession issues. And I think it does what it does and does it really well because I think it's how God designed the church to function. And so not that we have it all figured out, just 99% of it. And so,
just more than everyone else.
Right. Yeah, it's just, I mean, we're just, I mean.
Here at Globo Gym, we're better than you, and we know it.
That's exactly right. No judgment zone here.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, but anyway, so what I want to do is I really want to jump in again, looking at this through three different lenses, through Jordan's lens of experience as a college student who came into the church, was saved at the church, and got to watch from as a college student this crazy growth and this spiritual chaos kind of taking place through your lens and as a young Christian. John, as having come on staff, John is one of those who, as we've said before, just hung around long enough. We finally hired him. It worked out pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so through a lens of a young man coming on staff and being in the inner workings of the staff perspective of this church that's just growing. I mean, for the first 7-8 years was growing 100% to 200% year over year. And so, and then from my perspective of being the founding pastor of the church that began to take off and grow. So we got some really unique, I guess, vantage points. And so I want to start with those first memories. So, and I'll start with you, John. What is your first memory of not the church, but of you and I doing ministry together?
So I met you because I was a senior in college, was doing a internship at the Averett Center. I was a PR major, and some good friends of mine were working at First Methodist, which is where you were the youth pastor there. I didn't know you at the time, but I knew them. And so all throughout college, they had been doing various things for that church. And so they needed basically somebody to come on, or you needed somebody to come on for the summer to help with worship. And so I came on as an intern over the summer to lead worship. And people that go to this church know that I don't lead worship. And so they really had a thing of you would take anybody then. And I think that's what, again, allowed me to have a job later, is that you would take anyone. So, but yeah, that's how we kind of first met. And I'm just getting to know this guy that's used to be a roofer, apparently, and now it's just, you know, doing student ministry. And there, I want the church to understand, there is video content that could be used to blackmail Brandon Williams. And if he chooses to ever cross me, I do have this saved away.
And some of it's not that old.
But yeah, I mean, really, it was just got to know you over summer, us just trying to just have fun with student ministry. Student ministry is a wild ride, and you can just do a lot of fun things. And so really, it was just us trying to honestly love on these kids, but also just, you know, cut up a little bit. And that's kind of how we got to know each other.
Yeah. I still remember the first time you walked in, you had on jeans, flip-flops, a T-shirt, your hat on backwards.
Here we are.
Hey, he hasn't changed.
I'm a man of consistency.
20, you know, they play 21 the years.
The hits.
Yeah. You find what works.
Can you do that rendition? Which worship song was it you did that summer where you tied in "Don't Stop Believing"?
I tied in a couple of different songs. You got to understand, that was the season. I mean, we did the intro
to "Sweet Child of Mine," I think, at one time.
We did do that as well.
Yeah, our electric guitar player was good. He was a high school kid. Mm-hmm.
Not sure if he still loves Jesus or not, but
not sure he loved Jesus then,
but he was good at guitar.
But he was really trying to impress the girls who were sitting in our youth group. I looked over there at him, and he's like leaned back like Slash. And he's like looking at all the girls just nodding his head. I'm like, this is not where I thought this was going, That's a funny memory, and John would later become the student pastor at Connection, one of his first roles on staff with us. And so, John, up until that point, I guess, or maybe even the point of the church starting, what was your spiritual journey like up to that, like your background, I guess?
Well, I didn't grow up in church. I didn't start going to church until I was a sophomore in high school. I was working as a courtesy clerk at Kroger. I was not a bagger. We were very specific about that. but a guy that I was working with, he invited me to basically their youth group. And so I went there and just started going to youth and just kind of... I would say that we grew up in a Christian home, but we didn't go to church, so whatever that is worth. And so I started going primarily to youth group towards like my senior year. I started going on Sundays a little bit, but really most of my time before college was just a student ministry. When I got to college, I pretty quickly got involved in a couple of different college ministries here at Georgia Southern, got involved in leadership pretty quickly, and really that's where I started kind of really growing in my faith and growing in just more opportunities to be in more leadership type roles. Yeah. And I think at that point, so much of my family is like, oh, he's going to be in ministry. And that's what, and for me, I was just like, I think I just love Jesus. And I just wanted to be involved and wanted to be around. And I didn't feel like what I was doing was anything different. And then a lot of my like core group of friends were around you during kind of the first Methodist time, whenever y'all were starting Selah there, and then whenever the church was first started, was right about the time that I had graduated and moved back up to Atlanta. Yeah. But I'm hearing about all this stuff that's happening, and so I'm kind of getting a little bit of like this desire, like I want to be down there. I want to be around what all is happening because it just seemed like, you know, God was moving. I did hear that y'all were handling snakes at that time as well during that season. So I thought that was interesting.
That's always been high on my list of worship practices.
So there was a lot of things that were going, rumors that were spreading during that time. But I ended up moving back to Statesboro because I was living in Atlanta at the time. I had started a production company and was having trouble breaking into the Atlanta market. So I came down here to kind of build my portfolio. That did not grow great. And so I was not making much money. And so that was where I did start just kind of hanging around the church. And I remember my first Sunday here was the Sunday we tore down the wall that we've talked about before in the Blue Building. So that was literally my first Sunday. I brought all my sound equipment. And so that became the church's sound equipment. but it was just kind of, I wasn't married at the time. And I just was enjoyed. I didn't have anything else going on. I just enjoyed being around it. It was just fun to be around. And so that's when I think you felt bad for me and knew that I needed to eat. And so
I just didn't want to lose your sound equipment.
Right. That might have been it too. So ended up coming on staff, but again, not because I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to be in ministry. I almost didn't even think about it that way. I just thought like, oh, this is a job. And I think it was just kind of one thing led to another. And then when you came to me and said about students, I was the only other person on staff, and you said, hey, we need to start a student ministry, and I'm not doing it. And I felt like that was probably the sign that I was going to be doing that. But I, for the longest time, even people would start calling me Pastor John to like mess with me. I'm like, guys, I'm not a pastor. And then I think really the Lord began to show me that like maybe that was the story he was beginning to write. And I still struggle with it at times, but I do feel like it was like, well, maybe this is what I'm supposed to do. And so kind of just kept on going. But like really even coming on staff, I remember we did a series called Church Talk back in the Blue Building.
Yeah.
And it was basically all the different big words of Christianity, like sanctification and justification, glorification, that like sometimes a lot of people just don't know. And I remember that was the first time I'd ever heard those words. Yeah. And I'm on staff at a church. I think I was even student pastor at this point. And so like I was still in a lot of ways, like I didn't go to seminary. I, again, didn't start going to church until later. And so much of my ministry experience is job experience.
Yeah.
Like, and so a lot of my journey, even while being on staff, has been me just trying to learn and understand everything about this. So I feel like I've always kind of been playing from behind. But I think that also is what gives me a unique perspective, is because it's all been on the job experience.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Well, and you've always applied yourself really well and learned quick and studied the things you were doing, which has always made you, I've never felt like you were behind. Mm-hmm. So I always thought you were ahead and have always been a huge asset to everything we've done. So Jordan, you were a college student who came to Georgia Southern as a not saved, an unbeliever.
Correct.
So what was your first memory of Connection Church? The first time you ever came to Connection, were you saved?
No. it's a little bit of a blur. All just kind of blends together.
It was one of those.
I think this is a cool memory that I remember coming to the Blue Building for FCA.
Yep.
When Billy was hosting services and I just had guys from Toombs County and Vidalia, where I was on a Toombs County alum. And then there's another lesser school in town called Vidalia, and they would come over, and there were a lot of Georgia Southern students from that town. Mm-hmm. And they were inviting me like, hey, you should come to FCA. You should come to this thing. You should come to this Bible study. And I was like, let me see what I can work out with my drug dealer, and I'll try to swing by. And so that was like one of my earliest memories. I can remember the guy that I did a lot of drugs with was like, you know, the way we live, we really should like think about God a little bit more. And I was like, yeah, for sure. And I can remember sitting at an FCA thing, texting with another person of like, hey, you want to go buy some drugs later? And that's my earliest memory. And then I just remember life getting increasingly darker, lonelier. I just can look back now and see how God was removing people, not by my choice, not because I wanted them out of my life, but I just remember like a friend gets arrested for this and he gets shipped over there. And then this other person transfers to another school because, you know, mom's not happy about the decisions he's making here in Statesboro. And I remember eventually looking around at like all these people that I'm partying with. The only thing we really want for one another is what we want from one another.
Yeah.
It's not because of, I don't want to be around this. I don't want to be, are these people my friends? Or are we just all using one another?
Yeah.
And I'm not better than them. I was doing the same exact thing. And so, but I just remember eventually what was left standing was these guys that loved Jesus, that lived in the same trailer park that I did, that they just happened to be doing a Bible study on the book of Romans. And mm-hmm. So I remember going through that Bible study was hosted by Billy and his single wide trailer, and Buck was leading it, and Jake Ware was in it, and Adam Beckstein was in it, and all of these guys. I think Sam Rogers might have even been in there with us, and I just remember getting to the end of it and hearing the voice of God say, like, if you want a different life, here's your opportunity. Yeah. And I just remember taking hold of that, and my life was never the same.
That's cool.
But I remember, like, then sort of after salvation, still, like, coming to the 1 p.m. service at the Blue Building. Because that was, like, church in the afternoon. Sign me up. Yeah. And still trying to figure out who I am in Christ, but trying to say no to an old way of life, trying to say yes to a new way of life. Yeah. And I can just remember coming to those services at the Blue Building, and then shortly after, I'm getting plugged in with I got baptized in somebody's swimming pool somewhere in the middle of that, and yeah. That picture popped up. I think I showed it to you the other day of Brandon and Matt Wise baptizing me in some whose swimming pool was that?
I think it was the Meek.
It was probably Frank and Joan Meeks.
Mm-hmm. I just remember somebody texting me an address, and I remember driving from Toombs County, and I was on the interstate and, like, wanting to update my parents to some degree, but at the same time wrestling with, like, are they going to be, like, offended? Because I was baptized as a kid, and so
yeah.
But anyway, those are some of my earliest memories is those Blue Building days and then the high school days. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just like my first introductions to following Jesus was like through a small group and then set up and tear down at the high school.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah. I remember you being on that set up and tear down team, faithful to that. I mean, that definitely was not at 1 p.m.
Nope.
That was 5:30 a.m. No. Until about 1:30 p.m.
Yep.
But definitely remember you being a part of that. And there's so many of the guys and girls your age that were kind of a part of our foundation, really, of what God was doing. Even though it was college students, there was a solid, solid group of guys and girls who came through at that same time that were really a big part of the backbone and meshed so well with the older people, like my father-in-law, that he'd be there at 5:30 and might be bunch of college students and then three or four 60-something-year-olds that were doing setting up, you know, and tearing down. And it was such a cool kind of mix of things, you know. And, you know, in hindsight, you look back at things and remember them better than they were because actually all that tearing up and setting down sucked. But it was, but there were the good parts of it too, where you had that community of people.
That's right.
So that's really cool. And, and I remember it just, I can remember, of course, the first time we ever met in my house. I remember sitting there and it just feeling kind of like, okay, what's going to happen? Having a strong conviction for it. I remember moving to the Pond House and the awkwardness of seven people the first night and then really some powerful services. And then I can distinctly remember the very first service we ever did at the Blue Building that was not a Monday night because, you know, we're doing Monday night services to begin with in the Blue Building in one little part of it. And for a while, we'd be in there on Monday night at 6:30, and they were renovating the area that we'd ultimately use as the first, you know, sanctuary, auditorium area, whatever. And I'd be talking, and they'd still be in there hanging sheetrock, and I'd be like, and Jesus said, you know, with a drill. And so I remember that. But I remember the very first Sunday, February 1st of 2009, and sitting in my office before that Sunday service and not knowing, like, knowing somebody was going to show up, but I didn't know who. And I'm kind of sitting there at the desk and going, what the heck are we doing? and just having this almost like a, felt like a panic attack of like, what are we doing? And then all of a sudden it was like the Spirit just shot through me. It was like an electric volt. And I literally jumped up out of my chair and kind of ran around the front of the desk. And I was like, I don't know what just happened, but I think it was God saying it's going to be okay. And so, you know, and then from there, you know, you show up every day of your life and you don't have a clue what you're doing because everything's new.
I was going to ask you that, like, we're, because the
Connection was the first set up, tear down, not traditionally structured church I had ever attended. We went to plenty of First Baptist this, First Baptist that, local Methodist church this, but like, where did you even get the model for that?
We had attended a more charismatic type non-denominational church, so I had seen contemporary worship. We had actually before that even we had done the Selah service at First Methodist, so I had the idea of what.
So there's some bootstrapping involved in that.
Yeah, like, there was a history of some contemporary worship services and stuff like that.
The like mobile setup, the like that kind of thing,
and that really happened. I mean, that wasn't until year 3 or something like that we went to that, and so I think that came from we started seeing some other larger churches that were out. We're kind of seeing similar things where you were just growing at such a
other
rate.
Churches that had similar mission, vision, values.
Yeah, but I would say though a lot of that we kind of just had to figure out too.
Yeah,
because if you remember, my big project was we weren't going to buy the pipe and drape. I was going to build it out of PVC pipe.
I recall.
And we had Don and someone else who was building it in the back of the blue building. And I got back there, and it looked more it did not look like what I had drawn. And
but we actually used that for several months. And
yeah,
then we
even
realized
though it fell on kids,
it did fall on kids. But
and so
we had them sign waivers. That's fine.
Yeah,
but we learned sometimes you do need to spend some money.
Spending money saves you a lot of time and headache and knots on kids' heads.
But in a lot of ways, I mean, there were a handful of churches that just in the country that were starting to do that. But yeah, I mean, I think we were more on the front end.
I think that's what
that.
I'm wanting to draw out is like that was very new here.
Yeah, so we were, I think, trying to figure out a lot of stuff. And I remember when we moved into the high school, we were trying to figure out how can we do one service here. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I think the biggest crowd we had ever had was right at 500 people, mm-hmm. the total number of people right. for a Sunday in 3 services. And that was an Easter. Mm-hmm. And our average attendance, I think, was somewhere around 300 to 350.
We had been creeping up to that 500 number to where, because we were at that point where we had to go to those 3 services.
Those 3 services. And I remember thinking, we're moving into the Statesboro High School auditorium that held like 1,000 or 1,050 people, mm-hmm. something like that. And I'm like, it's going to feel empty. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, we put pipe and drape halfway up the auditorium. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, I hope we can pull off one service because of all the setup, all the tear down. Man, because we were hauling in 3 trailers. John had this thing schematically drawn out where mm-hmm. – if you did not put every box and cart and crate in exactly the right spot, you could not close the doors. And more than one time, I saw the look of frustration on John's face when he came out and the doors
tried to hide it,
would not close. And he's like, and he just has to pull everything back off and put it back in, right? But we're hauling literally 3 trailers of stuff in and out, and we're thinking, can we just pull off one service? Well, then the auditorium fills up. And we start doing 2. And so what we were wondering if we could ever do one time a Sunday, we're all of a sudden doing twice. And it was literally, it was 5 o'clock or so in the morning, 5:30 to 1:30 every afternoon. And every afternoon that we closed those trailer doors, I was like, thank God we made it one more week. Mm-hmm. And so it was like having a tiger by the tail, man. I mean, it was a blur. And, you know, I mean, we started church, I was 33. That felt old then. I look back now and I'm like, I had no idea what I was doing. And so, you know, it was challenging. But we always had good people around us. And that was the biggest thing is God. And people will ask a lot of times, you know, what, you know, kind of made the church successful and that kind of thing. But one of the things I'll always say is God has always surrounded us with good people. Mm-hmm. Sent some knuckleheads too, but for the most part.
Some better than others.
Yeah, I mean, you can't win them all. But for the most part, we've been surrounded by really, really good people. Mm-hmm. So,
but I think it was like what drew a lot of people is it was such, especially when you're set up and tear down and you're growing at the rate you are, it's obvious to the people around what's happening, and yeah. they wanted to be a part of that. Like there was right. something about like they there was now there was a, the other side was people were skeptical, they were, you know, and maybe hesitant. You had another group that was like, I just want to be a part. I just want to. And so there was this like, and I think that's going back to what you talked about of like older people and younger people. It just it didn't matter. People were like, I'm just excited about what's happening, and that's tough to recreate like that type of energy and excitement, because it was just such a you saw the growth, you saw the change, you saw all those things, and so people couldn't deny that.
Yeah, it was just something that was very tangible at that time, and like I said, I think the older people drew off of the younger people's energy, and the younger people, I think, were able to glean from the wisdom of rubbing shoulders with some of the older people. And it was just a unique dynamic that really was something that was hard to create once we moved into this building, because we lost that aspect of it that I think as hard and challenging as it was at times, it actually was a healthy dynamic in a lot of ways too. Gave a lot of people a lot of purpose, I think, in the church.
Mm-hmm.
So, cool. Well, you know, as we look back, we talked about some of the major markers in our timeline. November 17th, the first time we met in our house. Then December 1st, I think, would have been the first time we ever met on a Monday night at the Blue Building. February 1st of 2009 was our first Sunday service. Were you at that first Sunday service, John?
Mm-hmm. I wasn't back yet.
Okay, I didn't know if you were back yet or not. And Jordan, you would not have been. You were probably still high somewhere on that Sunday morning.
Still am.
Just high on Jesus.
That's right.
And so this episode may never air.
Do you remember the feeling going into the first time people are going to meet at your house? Like, what time did y'all meet?
I think probably 6:30.
What are you feeling and thinking about 6 p.m.?
Everybody thinks I'm stupid.
That's fascinating. What did you plan to preach on, or what did you preach on?
So that night, I just shared what was
the vision,
our heart.
Yeah.
You know, the first 2 weeks were just basically us saying, this is what's in our heart to see happen. And I told Susan, I was like, I don't think I'm very good at doing the little just sitting around chatting.
Yeah.
Kind of, and she was like, yeah, you're not. And just start preaching.
Yeah.
And so we did that the next week. And that's when we had 7.
Nice.
And so I always say, but I've said it 1,000 times, but people are like, is it hard to preach in front of like 700-800 people, 1,000 people? I'm like, no, it's hard to preach in front of 7.
That's hard.
Yeah, that was the harder thing.
My first sermon was in front of 4 staff members and 1 first-time guest.
Yeah.
At a church.
Yeah.
And it was a full storefront. Like, that's the hardest.
What's incredible about it, though, the part you're not telling is that 3 of them got saved.
Including it was me. Yeah. I was one of them.
He responded to his own altar call.
I was that good.
Yeah. That's amazing. Oh, man.
But I think that's probably a side of it that maybe I haven't even really gotten a chance to hear is that. And I hope it's empowering to someone of like, yeah, you don't feel this like, man, I can't wait for these people to hear what I have to say. You're like,
it wasn't. I can remember sitting down with people at lunch and telling them once we decided, you know, and we were kind of starting to meet at my house or whatever, and there were people that I felt like it was important to let them know, and just sitting down and telling them, and then like all you hear is like forks and clinking and eating, you know, like nobody, and you just feel dumb.
Yeah,
you just feel like, yeah, man, like I know this, probably screwing up, you know, doing something wrong, and or they think I'm dumb, or they think it's not gonna work, or whatever, and then you just keep going, you know, and so and that's
I think that's the part about the whole thing that was so powerful and what like changed my life is these are people actually living by faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's something alive and sacrificial and real that like to for whatever you started to have like changed the hearts of other young men my age that then came and like pulled me out of darkness. Mm-hmm. And then for there to be something that does require set up, tear down, it just was so contrary to standard institutional mainline churches.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and I've talked about this a lot, but it wasn't an easy thing. It was hard. Mm-hmm. Like it was extremely hard. And that's where we'll get into some of this as we go through the other podcasts as well is, man, like if I could have had people, I had people around me, if I could have had people beside me mm-hmm. that were walking and doing and had the same responsibility, the same authority, the same,
shouldering the load.
Yeah, that we were carrying it together mm-hmm. versus me feeling like I was carrying it all. Mm-hmm. And some of that, again, that was an issue of identity, and it was an issue of my own perspective. But I remember praying for years, Lord, just send me a mentor. Mm-hmm. Just send me somebody. I'm like, does nobody see this church growing? Does nobody see what God's doing that wants to step in and help and mm-hmm. like just help me? Like, Lord, since, and then finally 5 years in, I was like, I ain't praying for that anymore. Evidently mm-hmm. they ain't coming. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and so it was difficult. And, you know, gosh, man, for the first 2 or 3 years, I felt like I'd done something wrong.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much criticism and just yeah. negativity towards things. And I was like, you wake up in the morning and feel like you did a bad thing, mm-hmm. but people were getting saved and baptized. And yet the voices you hear are the negatives and not the,
from the audience that should be your ally.
In many ways, you know, to start with, in the very beginning, the criticism came from outside because there weren't a lot of people inside, and the ones who were inside were with you.
Oh, I just mean other Christians.
Oh, yes. So, like, I never had...
Other people at churches, maybe I should say.
Yeah, and so I think I could safely say 90 to 95% of the criticism I and we have received over the years has not come from unsaved people. And, and so that was the way it was when we started. I got accused of writing letters to other churches, recruiting their members. Never did that. I've invited one person that went to church, to this church, in 18 and a half years. And because that's not what we set out to do. Mm-hmm. Discouraged our people from inviting church people. Like, we're not here to swap sheep. We're here to find lost sheep. And so go find them. Don't recruit people who are already saved. And so, you know, you just heard a lot of stuff. There was a lot of stuff going around. And I think now looking back, if I could have started out with, and it had been, there'd been more people carrying that burden, it would have saved a lot of heartache. And I think the church would have been healthier for it too.
And I think what's interesting now, even just as you're talking, thinking about that, is that, like, in some ways I was there during that.
Yeah.
But I think the burden that I was carrying alongside you was more the logistical, just day in and day out, just making church happen.
Yes.
Not the emotional and even spiritual side of things. Mm-hmm. And probably wasn't at the age or maturity in my own day.
It wasn't your fault.
Yeah,
it wasn't your time.
But I think it was interesting to not even, some of that I was aware of that you were going through, and some of it I think wouldn't be until years later to even know that, like, that was occurring. And yeah. So, but I think that was also, it was like, we were just trying to hold on. And, just, you know, trying to survive. And so, but it's just interesting to think about now, like, what all is happening underneath the surface that, and some of it, I don't even think you were aware that it was taking the toll that it was.
Yeah. I knew I wasn't right, mm-hmm. which Susan would probably say I've never been right, mm-hmm. but I knew things weren't right, but I also couldn't have told you exactly what was happening.
Because it's paired with incredible things.
Yeah.
And so it's like that almost masked, I think, probably how hard and difficult it was because the other side was like, I mean,
good things are happening.
Yeah.
So you can't quit. You can't stop. You can't slow down. Mm-hmm. You just keep pressing forward. And, you know, and physically I'd done a lot of things in my life, whether it was athletics or roofing or whatever, where if you were tired, you just push through. But when it comes to spiritual and emotional and mental things, you just can't do that.
Yeah.
It's a different type of energy that's there. And, you know, you can try to be as tough and gritty and all as you want to be, but you're going to hit a wall. And when you hit that wall, that's it. Mm-hmm. And that wall for me was, you know, around 2013, 12, 13, 14. And I hit it hard, you know, as I do with most things. When I hit it, I went all out, you know, and smack that wall, boy. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that was tough, man. You know, I think about just, gosh, it's kind of funny, but Susan, y'all know that quilt I have in my office that Susan had made for me. She took, this has been several years ago, but she took a bunch of the t-shirts we had done throughout the years, and she had it made into a quilt where you can have all the different VBS t-shirts, Heart and Soul t-shirts. And she handed it to me and I opened it and I was like, thank you for reminding me of the worst years of my life. And I mean, of course, joking, but I do think back to a lot of those times where, man, it was great things were happening, but it was so hard to enjoy because I was so tired, man. Mm-hmm. Like, and so, you know, you think about things, and I jotted this down just to bring up, but John, you will remember this, and Jordan, you may remember us announcing this, but when we announced 1&1.
Mm-hmm. So 1&1 was this idea that we had come up with that we had already purchased land, and we were setting up and tearing down at Statesboro High School, but we knew we needed to build a building. But from the very beginning, like, building a building just felt icky, I guess. And we had been so missional. We had been so outward focused. And so we had come up with this idea of, for every dollar, up to $1.5 million that we were going to raise, that we wanted to have an additional dollar go to missions and outreach. But the issue was that on the beginning, it wasn't 1&1, it was just one. Yeah. Because we're thinking we got to raise $1.5 million, and that might have well been $10 million. I mean, it was...
Because that was so far out of reach for us.
And so we're already known, we're about to announce to our church, we got to raise $1.5 million to break ground. We made a video for this. We put a lot of energy into it. We were excited about this. We were like, this is going to be good. We're going to, you know, really launch into this. And you came to us the morning of, and we went over to this side hallway in the high school where we actually did our prayer hallway. And it was some of our staff and some of our elders. And again, we had been praying for this day. We had videos ready. And you're like, guys, we don't need to raise 1.5. We need to raise $3 million. And we about voted you out in that moment.
And part of me probably would have been okay.
Yeah. But honestly, like, what's so crazy? As soon as you said it, I mean,
it was unanimous.
It was unanimous. And it was one of those, like, you think about, like, in Acts when they talk about unity, like, that was what we experienced. It wasn't like I don't know, Brandon. Yeah. It was just like, of course.
Yeah.
Like, why would we as Connection Church do anything different?
That's right.
And like, that was and then it was just this, like, kind of, not in a prideful way, but like a badge of honor of like, this is how we should do things. Yeah. We should always take swings like this to ensure we don't get lost in the things that so many churches can't get lost
in. And it's something that I've said in the past, and we've all talked about it, but at some point in a church's life, it's so easy for the voices on the inside to become louder than the voices on the outside. And that was one of the things we were trying to avoid with 1&1, is that every dollar we get for this building, we're going to put a dollar somewhere in the community or in the missions. And we didn't want to be so inward focused. Mm-hmm. And God met that goal, man, and somehow. And so that still blows my mind that it actually happened. Mm-hmm. But that was a cool, cool day, and it was a cool moment when everybody was like, yeah, mm-hmm. let's do that.
And that goes back, go ahead.
Well, see, my perspective, I can vaguely remember that day in the announcement.
Yeah.
But my experience at Connection, just the complete like introduction into the faith that I'd had, I was like, yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Like just was it was just like a normalized like this is what Christians do. Of course we're gonna raise a guy can raise $3 million. What's the big deal? Yeah, like it just was so like you had set a culture of normalizing radical obedience to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And if you're saved, if you have been redeemed from the darkness of sin, of course you're going to now live a radically different life than whatever you lived before.
Right.
And so it just, I don't even remember that being like a, I didn't like go home and like,
ooh.
Yeah, I wasn't eating lunch with my friends being like, are these people crazy?
Yeah.
It just was like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's neat. Hmm. Yeah. And so we, that was one of those things where, you know, I vividly remember, and help me with this, but I believe, didn't we move into this building on March 15th of 2015?
Mm-hmm.
Believe that's correct. Mm-hmm. If not, I've been saying it wrong since March 15th of 2015. But, and so we moved in here, you know, those years for me were some years of kind of recovery. I think probably around 16, 17 is when I finally started kind of feeling better, started coming out of some things. And that was when we started feeling a really strong pull towards more of equipping our people to own their faith. And you remember we came out with the DIY Bible study and really started talking about those foundation cracks and things like that. And I remember we spent so much time talking about the foundation cracks that people actually left. They were like, we're tired of hearing this stuff. But, you know, we were looking at how Jesus is the foundation and he's not cracked. Like, he is a solid foundation.
We had to clarify that, too. People didn't like that.
Because people were, you know, Jesus ain't got no cracks. It's like, well, okay. But anyway, he is the foundation. But a lot of times, the way we talked about it, we left stuff out that created cracks in the church's foundation. You know, like people having to hear a clear call to follow Jesus. Mm-hmm. So many people can go to church for years and years and years and never hear a clear call to follow Jesus. People hearing a clear call to fullness in Christ, to grow into maturity. People hearing a clear call to the body of Christ and being a part of his church, and then people hearing a clear call to the mission of Christ and being missional, sharing the gospel to the ends of the earth. And so we really began to focus a lot on that and really trying to get people to, you know, basically more emphasis on the equipping aspect of things and really, really, really pushing for that. And I remember feeling some sense of satisfaction when we had been pushing the DIY and saying, like, you've got to be able to do this. You need to be able to own your faith. You need to be able to read your Bible and saying all of this. And then in 2020 in February, everything shut down. And I was like,
how do you do this again?
There was part of me that would just go, told you so, you know. But then, so that was kind of a big push for us that started, you know. And really, I think the first time we started talking about kind of the broken system of the church was back in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had to keep in mind, like, a lot of this is coming out of what I went through, right? Is realizing, like, this is too much for one person to carry. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, something's not right here. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what it is, but something about how we're doing this is not healthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just kind of trying to figure out, like, God, what is it that we're doing that isn't the way it should be done?
Well, I think that goes, as we were growing at the rate that we were, it felt as though, from a staff perspective, that we're just having to, like, hold all this stuff up. Like, just please don't fall, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that was what And it felt unstable. It felt like at any point somebody could pull something out and would the whole thing collapse.
Yeah.
And that's when I think for you, when you started recognizing whether it was cracks in the foundation or whether it was the system that we had kind of either inadvertently created or just were just trying to maintain. And I don't think it was just like we were doing unbiblical things necessarily. No. It was just that like it wasn't really built in the way that it wasn't complete.
Yeah.
It was like we had started the process and we realized there are some things that still need to be added and grown in this church.
And I think that's even one of the ways we talked about it for a while was we're not saying that what we're doing is wrong, mm-hmm. but what we are saying is what we're doing is not complete mm-hmm. and not completely the way that God would want it to be done. Mm-hmm. And so I do remember that. And you know, I remember us going into COVID and that being a whole deal in and of itself. And what's interesting about that is if COVID had happened in 2015 with where I was identity-wise and so much of my identity wrapped up in the church, if it had happened in 2015, I would never made it through it. Mm-hmm. But by 2020, because of a better understanding of identity and who I am, like, I mean, I know 2020 was a bad year for a lot of people and a lot of bad things happened, but it wasn't that bad of a year for me. Mm-hmm. They shut everything down. I just went turkey hunting. Mm-hmm. I was like, things are going to be fine. It was bad for turkeys.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, DNR's trying to figure out why our turkey population dropped. I'm like, I can tell you, all the rednecks like me were out hunting when y'all shut everything down.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's like one of those things where you look at it and that was a real healing time for me in that. But there was also an unrest and a unsettledness of we got to figure out what's missing. Mm-hmm. What's missing that can help us be a healthier church. One of the things that was interesting, and this goes back to, you know, 2000, I guess it would have been 13 or 14, kind of in the midst. And this was a wake-up call that wasn't due to my struggles with health or mental health or anything like that. But it was when we sat down and began talking to the bank about getting a loan. Mm-hmm. And they looked at me and they were like, you're not going anywhere, are you? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know. I could walk out and leave the bank and get hit by a car. I don't know if I'm going anywhere or not. But the loan was somewhat based off of my promise that I'm not leaving. And something about that even kind of woke me up to a reality of, like, this shouldn't depend on me that much. Mm-hmm. You know, this shouldn't be so centered around one man that the loan is dependent upon my presence.
Right.
Like, the church should be dependent upon his presence.
Mm-hmm. Which, and I think in part of what you're getting at is that systems and structures in society now, when it comes to the church, are depending their confidence on how strong of a man does that institution have, not how strong is that institution.
Yeah, how strong is the man, and is he going to be around, and what kind of leader is he, and, you know, can he lead it to grow? And so, I mean, yeah, they're looking at it and basing it off of that.
Mm-hmm. Which, from a bank standpoint, I understand.
Absolutely. Right.
But that's the same thing that's happened now to the people.
Yes.
The people inside the church, and that's the problem.
That's what we had to get away from.
Right.
And so, and you guys, obviously, and our elders have been a huge part of that. And I know on April 19th of this year is when we officially announced to our heart and soul people the change of structure in our leadership. And one of y'all want to kind of talk a little bit about that and what that felt like?
Well, so what I was thinking about recently is how, to get to where we are now, like, it wasn't overnight. Like, it's taken years. And even it's thinking about what you just said, even when you recognize that with the bank, if something about this is feels weird, that's in 2013, you know, and now 13 years later is when we're like, all right, we're actually rolling out a different leadership structure. Yeah. So it literally took 13 years of just sensing at that point. But the one of the things I was thinking about was like that it's taken, it's even a plurality of people to arrive at where we're at. It wasn't just all on you. And what I was thinking about is like, and Jordan talks about this all the time, is there's a thing called working genius and how like there's different geniuses that we all have. And I think one of Brandon's geniuses is invention, and he's able to oftentimes see like the initial thing. And so when you first presented this idea of this broken system that the church is built off of, when it's so much is built off of one person, is you kind of casted that vision and knew this is where it needs to go. And I think that was right at the time that you're coming in, Jordan. And Jordan has this genius of discernment and galvanizing to go, that's the direction we need to go. And the big component of that was we have to focus on leadership development. Yeah. That like, if this is going to happen, we have to build up other people. And literally it was just like Jordan hit the ground running doing that and beginning to build up a larger base of people, but it still wasn't complete at that point. Mm-hmm. And I think that really probably about a year ago is when I started sensing we've got to put some structure into this so that this actually sustains beyond three of us, beyond our elders. How do we actually do this from even a bylaw standpoint, from even like the language we use, which is like my genius of tenacity of being able to like carry something to completion and going, we each had a different role to be able to do. And that was years long process to get to that. And just like you said earlier, we're still incomplete. There's still more work to be able to be done. But I think as quick as I want things to happen sometimes, like God gave us each piece at a time and we each had a role to be able to bring us to that. But to see how that's been able to happen has been a very, I think it's caused us to have to trust the Lord's timing. Yeah. And that has been a frustrating thing.
It's been super frustrating. I mean, even to the point where the meeting with Shane Duffy that day, and, you know, when kind of a lot of stuff kind of came to a head of like, you know, we got to change, there's got to be change. Right. We knew in that meeting that there had to be changes.
Right.
And I think if not for that meeting, I don't know if we would have ever got there, you know? But it's like we look back now, and you're right, it was the input of everybody, all of our elders. And we'll talk more about what that looks like as far as the actual structure in future podcasts. But I think, you know, it's been very life-giving. It has also been very frustrating at times, even after we've made the transition since we announced it. We kind of been functioning in it before April 19th of this year.
Internally, we had already been operating this way. But here's the thing that's so interesting is there was some, I think, just not fear, but just we didn't know what to expect when we're going to announce to everybody that Brandon's not the senior pastor anymore. He's going to be one of the pastors. Is like, it's just the idea of, what do you mean there's more than one pastor? Like, what do you mean there's more than one lead pastor? Like, we just had a lot of like thought of like, are people going to get this? Are they going to be like, what are y'all talking about? And I remember when we shared that, the response was, yeah, all right, of course. And it's the same exact thing that we've experienced probably since the very beginning, is that it's what seems like in some ways this is going to be a huge step. It's almost like the Lord's been preparing people on the way as well. And they're like, you know, you've said this before, there's been times that we've taken a step and people have been like, yeah, we've been waiting on you. Yeah, you know, it's like
expecting it and or either already thinking it happened.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, I think that day was encouraging because of so many people coming up and being like, I have had a couple of people like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen a church do. Mm-hmm. Like, that y'all are willing to spread this out. And, you know, and for people who don't know, but now we have our governing elders and our staff elders. And, you know, if you're a pastor, you're an elder. If you're an elder, you're a pastor. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we all have equal authority, but different functions and roles. And so, and it's been good. It's been healthy. And it's so good to know, like, from my vantage point, that I'm not carrying all of that anymore. And it's been that way for a while in practice,
right.
But officially announced that on April 19th. And so it's been good to see that and to be a part of that. So when we look back over the 18 years, John, you took a little hiatus from the church and went back to Atlanta for a while. What years was that you were out?
So we left in 2014 and came back in 2015. Yeah. So
Couldn't stay away long.
Couldn't stay away. But it really, kind of truth to that of the reason we left was me and my wife both grew up in Atlanta, always felt like we'd end back up there again and never really saw ourselves living in Statesboro the rest of our lives. And so we inevitably knew it was kind of time to go. We do that. Well, then the building is being constructed at that point. And so come, April of this building being built in 2015, it was so much a part of that process. We wanted to come down and just be here for the first week and just felt like that wasn't a thing that we could miss. And I'd already had multiple calls with you throughout that time because we were struggling in Atlanta, felt like it wasn't where we needed to be and just weren't struggling to try to find a home. And I remember we came here for that first service, and on the drive back, we looked at each other and were like, this is where we need to be.
That's cool.
And so we kind of learned that this is our community and this is what, and so that's kind of what brought us back.
Again. That's cool. Yeah. And I don't know. I just think it's really a neat story of y'all being able to go. And sometimes it takes kind of getting away for a little while and God making more, even more clear.
Well, it also reaffirmed, I think, probably my call to vocational ministry. Because I think when I left here, because even throughout the years that I was doing student ministry, I still wasn't like, I am going to be in vocational ministry the rest of my life. I was fine with it, but also wasn't like, I have to do this. And so I took a secular job after that and felt like, well, maybe I'll just do that for a while, and felt like this is not what I was created to do. Yeah. And so I think that was that. I think in a lot of ways that time helped clarify that for me, that this is what the Lord, has for me.
That's good. Jordan, you left right after college and went to seminary and then to D.C. So tell us a little bit about that as far as how'd you end up back here to be a part? Because, John obviously has been a huge part of this transition. But you also, and I think the timing of you coming back was crucial in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very kind of you to say. I feel like I was, I feel like I was as much of a hindrance as a help sometimes. So I graduated from Southern in 13, got married in 14. We moved to North Carolina for seminary in December of 14, started classes in 15. And, I just felt based off of my salvation, based off of like lots of different things, I was just like, man, I feel really unprepared for like, I feel like I don't know enough. Fast forward to today, what I would counsel somebody with probably is not necessarily seminary as important to pastoring as I felt it was at the time. But nonetheless, like, I see God's hand and grace in that.
Absolutely.
In that, like, you got a very opinionated, hard-headed, pebble-in-your-shoe college student out from under your hair.
No.
And got me to where it took me through a huge humbling process that I desperately needed and still need to this day. And so,
yeah. And one thing I will say, when Jordan got saved, he was so zealous for the Lord. And Jordan and there were probably four or five other of you guys that were so fired up for God. And the funny thing was, and we joke around about this, that Jordan was a pebble in my shoe, whatever. But really and truthfully, what I saw in Jordan and what I saw in these other guys was myself when I got saved.
Right.
And so we would all meet together, and sometimes those were the greatest meetings, and sometimes they were so frustrated. But I the one thing I kept seeing in you guys over and over again was, that was me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was me. That was me. That was me. That was me. And so you go to seminary, and mm-hmm. and then what was that like? I mean, was that – obviously it was
– Man, it was like heaven, honestly. Loved it. I mean, I'm working for a professor doing grading for him. I'm working at the library. Like, it's the closest thing that I could imagine heaven being like on earth. Like, yeah. Everybody that's there is as equally zealous for the Lord. Mm-hmm. I just remember walking around and, like, I had this testimony that I would share at Connect Group or whatever, and it's like, oh, that's crazy. And now at seminary, it's like, yeah, bud, we all, that's all of us, you know? Like, it was an important time to be like, oh, yeah, you're not that special.
Yeah.
And there had to be more to you than a radical testimony. Yeah. And I really appreciated that. And so it was just like, you know, people are giving their life to go to unreached people groups. People are giving their life to go and plant churches and go and pastor churches and, like, doing it with such joy and sincere character. So I loved it. I mean, yeah. I absolutely loved it. I mean, but I don't think it's for everybody. And I think I remember by the end of it, there was a dissatisfaction of, like, okay, we're arguing, we're using the same Bible verses to argue different perspectives and points.
Yeah.
But the conclusion is like, but if you would just, like, read the Bible, you would think this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't want to do this. Like, I don't want to argue over Greek apostrophes. Like, you know, there's not any. I'm joking. But don't come at me. But there's.
I can guarantee you the two of us weren't.
I was just like, okay, no apostrophes.
So anyway, I then I got Macy pregnant, and we had to get, like, we
had to get,
like,
married. Is that what? What did he say?
Do that. I'm just kidding. I knew I skipped this step.
He didn't, by the way, people.
Just, I am. Okay. All right. Gosh, I'm married.
And was married before.
Before. It's true. Yeah. So, yeah, they wouldn't have let me in the school if I wasn't. Before I'd gone to seminary, one summer I'd done an internship for a church plant in D.C., friend of a friend. If I start talking about it, I'm going to cry. And we're laughing this whole podcast, so we're not going to cry. But that mentor, that guy that did my internship, he had some church planting work in the Washington, D.C. area. We needed a full-time job. He was starting a church planting network, needed some help. So that took us to D.C. to where I eventually met another church planter named Greg Gibson. He was planting a church in Georgetown in the west side of Washington, D.C. All that to say, full circle from, like, when I was in seminary, I was like, I would take philosophy and I'd be like, oh, I want to be a philosopher. And then I would take ethics and I'd be like, oh, I want to do ethics. I'd take theology and I'd be like, oh, I want to be a theologian. And I would just on and on and on. And finally, like, the thing I couldn't get out of my soul was I could go to my grave having pastored and not been an academic and I'd be happy. But I couldn't have been an academic and not pastored.
Yeah.
That I would have been unhappy with that. So that's what eventually I'm moving out of, like, working for this network. I want to be a pastor. Mm-hmm. And Greg afforded me that opportunity. So that's seminary. I was going to get into the next part of it but I
will. Yeah, good. Go ahead.
The thing that brought me back to connection was I remember I was sitting on the waterfront in Washington, D.C., and I can remember praying, seeking the Lord, really trying to figure out what's next. And I can remember the Lord clearly. I remember I wish I'd have kept the piece of paper. I had this whole, like, one-page piece of paper and of, like, all of my heart's desires and, like, the things that I felt like the Lord was encouraging me to say. And he said, now call Billy Shiver and read that to him. And I was like, I hadn't talked to Billy in years. And so I called him, and he was like, man, that is super meaningful. I really appreciate it. Unfortunately, I just hired somebody, and I can't. But hey, let's keep thinking about it. And I was talking about it. And I was like, all right, that sounds good. And I hung up the phone, and I was like, okay, well, you know, you win some, you lose some.
Yeah.
And then I remember this Holy Spirit saying, now call Brandon and say, reading the exact same piece of paper. And I was like, no. Like, he does not want to hear from me. I haven't spoken to him in an even longer period of time. But I did. And sure enough, you were like, you won't believe this, but, like, we're about to pivot to something in the life of our church all around equipping and disciple making. And it sounds like, based off of what you've been doing, that's exactly what you've been doing. Maybe we should talk about it.
Right.
And that's when I came down to to interview when you told me Don was dead. And but the thing that I remembered that was so, one, we needed to get closer to family because Macy's dad was not in good health, is still not in good health, but he's still alive and kicking. And then, like, my dad had some back issues. My mom had some health issues. We just needed to be closer to family. But I remember in all of this that I had been chasing from seminary to all these other places, the thing that was always true at Connection, that has always been true at Connection, is that the Spirit of God was changing people.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do something with my life that I got to see real life change.
Yeah.
And that had happened at Connection when I was there. It had continued to happen. Mm-hmm. And in coming back and hearing what all God had done in Connection when I interviewed was just, that was the thing that, like, I only get one shot at this. Yeah. And I want to be around.
That's cool.
Real life change happening.
Yep. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
John didn't want me to be hired, by the way. He said that explicitly one day when I'd gotten here. He was like, I mean, Brandon hired you. I didn't want you here, but
I didn't use those exact words, but I said what I said.
I said what I said.
You have a standard. But
honestly, the jury's still out whether I want you here now.
That's
after this
good
podcast, I have a feeling the ratings.
Mm. Yes.
Tanking. Yeah. Well, and you know, and the timing of it again was really good. And we've all learned a lot through the process of all of this too. I mean, it's been crazy. And like you said, John, this didn't happen overnight. I mean, the first time we talked about the broken system was in, I believe, June of 2019. Mm-hmm. And here we are in April of 26, finally being able to officially announce some model of plurality that gets us out of that broken system. And we're going to talk a lot more about that broken system in coming podcasts. But really just today wanted to introduce some of the history and the why. Like, why was it even needed? You know, and as you look at it, the growth of the church locally, but also just worldwide, it can't be supported on the shoulders of a few people.
Right.
It takes everybody. And God instituted elders and pastors to lead the church for a reason, and to do that together. And that's what we're going to get into more and more as we go forward. You know, and just in brief, and I guess we can conclude with this today, what would y'all say, what would you guys say to the church leader, the elders, et cetera, that are operating? Because here's what we used to always say. We would always say we were staff-led and elder-accountable. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of churches operate that way.
Mm-hmm.
Staff-led, so it's more like you have a board than you have elders, right, performing spiritual roles. We've shifted to an elder-led church now, which is
staff.
I mean, it sounds like a duh, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the biblical way of doing it. And so we're staff led and or elder led, and then, you know, and our staff and everything flows out of the leadership of our elders and pastors. What would you guys say to encourage a church leader who's maybe where I was or where we've been, where they're hanging on, but they know it's too much. What would you say to the elders of that church and the leadership that's there that are operating in this staff-led, elder-accountable model? I was watching a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and it was two really brilliant people. I consider them brilliant, which compared to me, that could be that Kleenex box over there.
Oh, my gosh.
But when I'm watching this, and it's like they're talking about secession and all this other stuff and pastor burnout and the loneliness of leadership and all this other stuff, and I'm like, those don't have to be things. Sure. You know, not that I'm smarter than them, but I think the Bible's smarter than them. But what would you say to that leader that's barely hanging on, to those elders that are operating as a board, to a staff that is leading and then looking to the elders for permission rather than being led by a spiritual group of elders? What would y'all say to encourage them today?
I think one thing that I know I fall guilty of a lot is the thought, if I don't do it, nobody else will, or nobody else can. And I think that's where a lot of leaders end up living, is they feel this pressure because they feel as though, well, God's appointed me. Who else can actually do this? And I think it's one of those things that I think we forget that, like, God isn't looking to each one of us and saying, all this is on you. Mm-hmm. Is I don't have anybody else around. I think we forget that. I think we forget the fact that, like, God actually does have people all around us that are able, but we have to probably pull our eyes up a little bit. I know one of the things that, you know, and I say this kind of in a joking way to our kids team, is that so often, like, on a Sunday, it's hard for them to leave kids to be able to go to a service. Mm-hmm. Because they don't want to let the other connectors down. They're like, well, they're crying babies, and and I got to stay here to help out. But my feedback to them is, but at the end of the day, you're just one person. Yeah. And if you were out of town this week, they'd have to figure it out. Yeah. And they do figure it out. Not that when they're in there, they're not making a huge difference. But the other side of that is, you're just one person. And I just think that, I think pastors a lot of times forget that God has more resources than just them. And if they're willing to step back and pull their head up to be able to see those that actually are running alongside them. Mm-hmm. And I just trust that I know the Lord's going to have those people there. Sure. And so I think that would be the thing that I would encourage, is that I think we've become convinced we have to do it like this and there's no other options and my back's up against the wall. And I think we thought that until we realized that it's actually not that.
That's right.
And so I don't know if that's helpful, but that's kind of what comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say it may not be your fault that it is the way that it is, but it is now your problem to solve. Mm-hmm. And like that may not sound like the encouraging part, but the thing that I would say is change is possible.
Yes.
That there, like, if God has called you to this work, then he's called other people to come alongside you.
Right.
I think that we should normalize expecting godly, humble, character-rich partners in the gospel. Mm-hmm. That you don't have to settle for incompetence, but you also don't have to tolerate ungodliness with competence. Mm-hmm. That it is that, you know, you have the chance to change things, and what you lead and exert your influence in the direction of, you can create change, and other people will benefit from your sacrifice. What I've seen a lot from Brandon is, in sometimes ways, honestly, as a friend, I wish you wouldn't, but in ways of, like, you took a lot of the bullets so that the rest of us could stay whole. Mm. And you paid a high toll and made a huge sacrifice that we could glean from the benefits of all of the wounds you're taking on our behalf. And one way I would highlight that is, as a college student, the whole time that in your circle, you were the coolest, most confident, most charismatic, most like if I could be anything when I grew up, I wanted to at least be like you. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea the darkness that you were walking through. And you carried a lot of that so that the rest of us could feel this level of enthusiasm and excitement. And what I would say to other leaders, pastors, elders, is that you need people that can walk along in the darkness with you so that you are reminded that you're not alone when you can't see it for yourself. And you don't have to settle for doing it the hard way. You don't have to... you don't have to settle for the way things are. There's too many other good gospel opportunities and too many other good gospel communities that you can still go forward glorifying the Lord Jesus and making much of his plan A with no plan B, which is the local church. And it doesn't have to look like the hot mess that maybe you're living in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I remember... it's not been but maybe a couple of years ago, I went out into the HM, which I tend to avoid because these are the conversations I end up in. But I had somebody come up to me, and they said, you know, I came and saw you at the high school. I'm like, they were coming to see me. I'm like, well, you came to see the wrong person if you came to see me. And they said, but you were too young. They said, you hadn't been through enough pain yet. And you hadn't suffered enough, and I thought he hadn't been through enough yet to really be able to speak to me. And I didn't say it, but I wanted to tell them, you know, you don't realize that those were the darkest days of my life. Mm-hmm. You don't realize that those were days that there were times I thought about eating a bullet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're going to sit there and tell me that I hadn't been through enough pain for you.
Yeah. What if that was God's signal to you, sir?
Yeah.
That you could have come alongside somebody and... Instead, when you make church about you, when you make it as a product you consume and not a people that you belong to, of course you come to those types of conclusions.
And so it was just interesting that from his perspective, I was in the darkest season of my life. And I can remember, man, being in those worship services at the high school, and there was one song that just killed me, man, that we would sing, and it was the song that had the line in it that's just said, I'm running to your arms. Mm-hmm. And like, I get choked up thinking about it now because I was hurting so bad in those days that all I wanted to do was to run into his arms. And, you know, and I think about the pastor who's in that place now, or that's hurting in that way, or that is carrying all of that load that they weren't meant to carry. And my encouragement in that is, again, it's a lot of what you both said, but you don't have to do it that way.
Right.
If you're an elder or on a board of a church, then you need to be a spiritual leader, not just a decision maker.
Mm-hmm.
And that transition needs to happen. When there's conflict in the church, it shouldn't be that the board sits around and makes a decision on what's going to happen and then looks at one person every time and says, you go have that conversation. It should be that there are multiple people who are able and willing to have that conversation. And I would encourage both elders and pastors who are in that place where they're still functioning in this very, you know, top-heavy model of leadership, that you are the bottleneck on the church's growth. You may think that you're actually helping it grow more by what you're doing, but ultimately, you're the bottleneck. You're the ceiling because you can only do so much.
Numerical growth.
No, I'm talking about all kinds of growth. Because here's the thing is like, what I began to realize is as I moved out of the way more and we began to have a more linear structure, other people had room to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like you needed to get saved. You're already saved, but you grew.
Mm-hmm.
you grew up to the measure that was there for you in that season. Same thing for you. Same thing for our elders.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, how much have our elders grown into being those spiritual leaders? And so, and we're all still growing, and we all still beat our head against the wall against things we're trying to figure out. But the reality of it is, the typical structure of the church today is a bottleneck because it all flows through one person, and it's not intended to do that. It's intended to be shared, and that is a healthier model. It's a more productive model. And I'll say this, and this, and we'll be done. You can think of a thousand reasons why this won't work,
right?
But I'll give you one reason that it will, because this is the way God designed it. And you can think, well, I preach better than. Then so and so, or people are going to want to hear. We've heard all of that, all of this stuff through the years. We don't hear it anymore because people have seen God move in different ways through different people, and other people have been raised up into those roles and into those positions. And now, when people get baptized and they're sharing testimonies, it's not a testimony of Jordan's message was so great that I got, or Brandon's message was so great, or John's message, or whoever's message they preached, and man, I just, they're talking about the person that's about to baptize them, that's walked through life with them and led them to Christ and is actually discipling them, and that is such a more healthy way.
Well, the thing that I was thinking about is something that you said months and months ago, Jordan, was that I think doing it this way, there is an aspect that sometimes this is harder. It is harder because you're having to lean on other people. And sometimes when you're the only one making the decision, it all falls on you. Sometimes that's a little easier.
It can be quicker.
It can be quicker. Certainly quicker. And that's why I said, is that the other side of that is that, but it's not healthier, and in the long run, it will be detrimentally harder because of what it'll do to you.
And maybe when I say, like, easier, it's easier in the way that, like, you know, like, a Snickers bar is easier to eat than a protein bar.
Right.
Like, sure, it may taste better for a little while, but too much of it's going to make you sick.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's...
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and because you gave me the book, but I was reading Legacy Letters yesterday, and... It's the chapter on collaboration. I highly recommend Legacy Letters by Chris Hodges. And in there, he quoted a Chinese proverb, and it speaks exactly what you're saying. The Chinese proverb says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was such a great... Great way of putting it.
That's really good.
Yeah.
We're going to dive more into what this actually looks like. I'd even like to, at some point, be able to look at our bylaws a little bit. Not something boring, but really be able to pull out some of the things and the specific things that we put in there to make sure that we don't end up back where we were.
Right.
And so I think that'll be fun, exciting, and must-see TV.
Thank you for listening to Equip. If you enjoyed today's video, we'd love it if you would click like, if you would subscribe to the channel. One of my favorite things is when I get stories from people that said, I really enjoyed what you guys talked about today, and I'm going to share it with a friend. So we want to continue to grow this channel to the best of our ability, not because it's monetized or that we get anything out of it other than the things that we really care about get shared with other people. So if you found any value in it, we'd love for you to share it with somebody. We will see you next week.